Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Today, what's it like to devote your career to writing personality profiles about the dead? Take it from the Atlanta Constitution's celebrated obituary writer Kay Powell, it's the most satisfying work you can imagine.
I'd go to my editor and I'd say, Laura, I've got to have more space. I have gone and fallen in love with this man. And she said, Kate, you fall in love with all of them. You have got to start falling in love with them when they're alive.
And then Yale law professor Stephen Carter has written a new novel about spying during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's a moment in history, he says, was unlike any other.
This is a moment that is as close to annihilation as the world has ever come in its history. And had a few decisions been made in slightly different directions, we would have had a war in which at least, at minimum, hundreds of millions of people would have been killed.
All that coming up on Two-Way Street, but first the news. We begin today's Two-Way Street with a conversation with one of the Atlanta Constitution's best-loved writers, Kay Powell. During her tenure at the AJC, Powell attracted a large circle of readers. She didn't write about hot new restaurants or blockbuster movies. She wrote about the dead. During her 13 years as obituary editor, Powell estimates she wrote more than 2,000 obituaries. She wrote about the famous, of course, but her specialty was writing about the so-called ordinary Georgians who had passed away. Powell's mission was to uncover facts about each individual life that made for often surprising, sometimes funny, but almost always fascinating obituaries. And when we read Powell's obits, we came to understand that no life could really be called ordinary. If you think devoting your career to covering dead people seems like a somber and depressing business, you don't know Kay Powell.
When I was obits editor at the AJC, we always said we write about how they lived, not how they died. If you go back and read those obits we wrote, and I say we because I had a team of writers through the years, different ones, there might be one sentence about death. There might be another sentence about funeral plans. At the tail of the story are survivors. In between, we sum up the person's life. Now, it's not a biography. It's not a eulogy. It's a news obit article. They are news. What's the first question people ask when somebody dies? And what's the second question? What did he die of? How old was he? So those two elements must be in a news obit article. It doesn't matter who you are. Now, we did have some women who kept their age such a secret, even their children didn't know. One who was a prominent businesswoman here in town even lied on her passport. So you kind of make that part of the story explaining why you're not telling how old they are, because even the children don't know enough to tell you.
Let's back up.
All right.
What was your thought when you were invited to take that position? How did you feel about that job?
I loved the idea because Ron Martin, who was the editor at the time, said he wanted to do two things. He wanted to write about ordinary people, and he wanted to create a sense of community for the readers to feel ownership in the paper. And I was so excited. And Bill, to the day I left, there was never a day I didn't go into work that I wasn't looking forward to it.
So an individual dies, you decide that you need to write the obituary of that person's life, and so you have to begin developing sources, those who knew that person well enough to give you the kind of information that could give you the opportunity to write a rich obituary, an accurate obituary.
Yes, accurate is the key word there. It's all a matter of building trust, and it starts a lot of times with the funeral homes that would give us the family contact information. How you approach that family when you get them on the phone, getting that conversation done, asking them for friends. It's always important to have an outside voice. And so I spent a long, long time giving my little spiel of who we write about and how we choose them and all like this to the funeral directors, to families that called in. Eventually, the readers caught on to what we were doing and loved it. And so a lot of times we would have them call and not necessarily tell us about a family member that they thought we should write about, but somebody in the neighborhood maybe that was unique, that was very little known, or just somebody interesting. So it was a complex system of building up trust.
But that first phone call.
Yes.
The phone is answered at the home where people are grieving, and you say, I'm Kay Powell, I'm with the Atlantic Constitution, and that can be a tough moment to get people to talk, can't it?
I used to teach an entire course on the psychology of words and how important it is. Usually it would be, I'm Kay Powell with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and I am not selling you a subscription. Mr. Smith at the funeral home gave me your number to contact you. I was so sorry to read about Mr. Nygaard's death from the information in the funeral home, and I was captivated by the fact that he spent his life collecting 45 RPM records. I want to talk to you about that to write an article in the paper. Is this a convenient time? And sometimes they would say, well, I can't talk right now. I'll talk to you next week. And you say, I would love to talk to you next week, except this is a daily story. And I can understand completely if you don't want us to write the story because you don't have time. Oh, no, I'll make time. I have time. But you start out with that sort of building trust, giving them confidence, letting them know straight up what you're calling for and what you're doing. And sometimes it takes a hard left turn. What you call up to start writing about in print winds up something entirely different because of your conversations with the family, with friends, your research and archives. You find a dimension to the person that you didn't know anything about.
This was a job that meant more than just gathering basic facts. This was delving into and creating as complete and accurate a portrait as possible.
One of my writers said, you know what Case is, bring them back to life. And that was our job, was to capture sort of what was the essence of them. And again, you can't tell their entire life story, but you want to capture sort of what defined them, capture some of that personality.
I believe you, at one point in your career, said, be careful about living till you're 90 because your obituary is going to be shorter.
The longer you live, your 90-inch obit becomes a 30-inch obit. Yes.
How did you decide which people would get obits and which wouldn't?
My whole career in journalism was in hard news and breaking news and as a news reporter. And that builds an instinct in you, coupled with a curiosity. And the least little item about somebody could catch my attention. I saw that somebody was a Kmart greeter, and I said, well, we've never written on a Kmart greeter. Well, it turns out the man had been CEO of an international furniture company. In fact, they made the furniture that was used in the house in the television show Dallas. He retired. He got bored. He missed being around people. So he took a job as a Kmart greeter. How can you know that? I saw that somebody priced groceries in a grocery store. I said, well, everybody has to buy groceries. We've never done this. Let's write on him. Well, it turns out he collected prize-winning show-quality skunks. And he even had a motorcycle with his best prize-winning skunk airbrushed onto it. I figured if I was curious about him, the reader would be too.
You wrote an obituary that really tells a pretty powerful story about a collection of people you would not expect to see together.
I loved it when we could reveal in our obits information that were little known or unknown, particularly about Georgia and Atlanta history. And when Jim Sanders, the wine merchant, died, I interviewed Doc Lawrence, who's in the wine community here, for his obit. And Jim Sanders at his wine shop had in the back what he called the soup kitchen. Every day he'd cook up a meal, pair it with the European wine, and those in the know knew they could go to the back room and eat and drink and talk. Well, one day in that room were former Governor Marvin Griffin, who was a segregationist, Ralph McGill, liberal editor and pro-civil rights advocate of the Atlanta Constitution, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who was in the shop buying champagne for his and Coretta's anniversary. The three of them wound up in Jim Sanders' soup kitchen, eating and drinking and telling stories and laughing and carrying on all day long. Jim had to run them out of the store to lock up for the night. And when he looked out the plate glass window on the sidewalk, those three men were still telling stories and laughing and slapping each other on the back.
And you learned all this as you researched the obituary of Jim Sanders.
Yes, when I interviewed Doc Lawrence, he told me this, and he said, Kay, I've never told this story to anybody.
You didn't write obituaries about people only. You wrote an obituary for the planet Pluto.
Yes, I did. It ran on the front page with a huge graphic, but I wrote the obit for Pluto the planet in our AJC obit style. And this was the lead. Pluto, the least of the major celestial bodies, never asked to be a planet. Once elevated, it became an influential figure in astronomy and astrology, in classical music, and in cartoons. And then in our obits, we always had a cause of death and funeral plans. So for Pluto, I said, no memorial service is planned because it has been several years since astronomers considered Pluto a real planet. And then at the end, we always listed survivors. So for Pluto, I said, survivors include eight planets: Earth, Jupiter, Mars, Mercury, Neptune, Saturn, Uranus, and Venus.
I'd like to read one back to you.
Okay.
And this is in keeping with the philosophy that Ron Martin suggested, which was that you write about ordinary people. And this one was very touching to me. Mike Huddleston, 44, Noonan. Every eight-hour shift, he worked at Delta Airlines. Mike Huddleston was responsible for getting 5,000 pieces of luggage to the correct spot at Hartsfield International Airport. His record was so outstanding that Mr. Huddleston was featured in a Discovery Channel special, The Secret Life of Luggage.
I saw that he was a baggage handler. I called the family. I got the usual things. I got information from them about his supervisor at Delta. And that's when, at the last minute, I got the details about his being featured in that Discovery Channel. On the job, he lost four fingers. Two were reattached, and two never were able to be reattached. But he kept a positive attitude working.
Bruce Williams of Coweta County. You wrote an obituary of Mr. Williams, and you learned something from Griffin Bell that you used in the obituary that was pretty interesting. What had Bruce Williams done?
Bruce Williams made a sausage that Griffin Bell called rooster pepper sausage, and it was famous and popular and well known. And when Jimmy Carter was in the White House as president, and Griffin Bell was his attorney general, Griffin Bell felt like they needed rooster pepper sausage. And Griffin Bell, the attorney general of the United States of America, would smuggle rooster pepper sausage into the White House, past the Secret Service, past all the guards, past all the checkpoints. And he had half of Capitol Hill hooked on rooster pepper sausage.
I want to share with you, again, something you wrote. You talk about how details enrich an obituary. Mm-hmm. And one sentence that you cite is, she was so little, her shorts met her socks.
That gave me an image immediately. I can still see that little girl in my mind.
But then you talk about clothing in a way that really gives us a very strong image of the kind of person you were writing about. Dale Sheriff, a construction worker. His Levi's always had a crease down the center of the leg, and he polished his work boots. We know a little about him, don't we?
You get a picture of him, I hope. I hope.
You get to know people, ironically enough, after they're gone in that job. There's got to be some slightly dissonant feeling about that, I would think.
It's a personality profile, but there did. In fact, I'd go to my editor and I said, Laura, I've got to have more space. I have gone and fallen in love with this man. And she said, Kate, you fall in love with all of them. You've got to start falling in love with them when they're alive.
In just a minute, we'll have more of my conversation with Kay Powell. She spent 13 years as the obituaries editor of the Atlantic Constitution before retiring in 2009. This is Two Way Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. My guest is Kay Powell, former obituaries editor of the Atlantic Constitution. You became very well known nationally, certainly in this, and we should point this out. There's quite an association, national association, of obituary writers.
Yes.
You all follow each other's writings Yes. over the years.
It's the Society of Professional Obituary Writers, and we are a small but thoroughly enjoyable group that it is international. We have members from, I think, Israel, Spain, Canada, Australia, the U.S., the Bahamas, from all over. We try to get together at least once a year. It might have to be every other year.
You became quite well known in that group for some of the people you chose to write about. So, for instance, chose to write an obituary of a grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Grand Dragon.
Grand
yes,
Dragon.
Calvin Craig. That was a challenge in talking to his family. I called them and they were resistant. And I explained to them because he was such a public figure, an article would be written one way or the other. And I thought it was important to have the family talk about him and get their voice in the article and get their perspective in the article. And I talked to the wife, and I talked to the son, and I talked to the wife, and I talked to the son, and I talked myself blue in the face, explaining. The son finally told me, he said, I just want it to be fair. And I said, I couldn't write it any other way. I understand completely if it was my daddy, I'd want a fair article, too. The wife even called Ron Martin, the editor, trying to stop the story. And he came down to the newsroom and said, I've gotten a call from. I said, Ron, he was a public figure. There's no way in denying we need to cover it. There needs to be a story. He backed me 100%. And when I got off the phone with the family talking to the son the last time, I got a standing ovation from the newsroom for the way I'd handled it. But it was a fair story. I talked about his work in the Ku Klux Klan. I talked about Zernona Clayton getting him to leave the Klan. They were served together in one.
Zernona
of the,
Clayton being one of the really great figures in civil rights.
Early, highly active civil rights activist and leader, not to be redundant, leader in the community. Fair. Nobody is 100% truly evil. And as you talk to people, you can find a spot in there. Like Zernona Clayton was helpful in pointing out some positive aspects of Calvin Craig.
What are some of the other obituaries that meant the most to you in your career?
All of them. Don't you hate that answer? Don't you hate it? I approached obits, or all my writing really is, I have to get my lead done first. And that sort of sets the tone for the whole rest of the story. And then I usually like to tie it up with a little bow at the end. I'm not all that good at that part of it, but I do work very hard on the lead. And there was something I liked and enjoyed about every single obit I wrote. And I do have a couple of my leads here that I like. And
you can kind of
see if you... one that I like, a short lead to me is always a better lead. And the lead on George Hopkins' obit said, George Hopkins died again Friday. That was the entire lead. In World War II, he tested diving equipment. You know, the old big heavy canvas suits with the huge metal hood. And drowned and died while testing one. And they got him to the surface and they resuscitated him. And he went on to become a lawyer here in Atlanta. He died at 83. His children went to a private school here, and one of the girls came home complaining one day about some homework, and they complained in class, and the teacher said, you don't have a license to complain. And so Mr. Hopkins that night drew up a legal license to complain for every child in that class. And said, so that's an example of you find another dimension in a person's life. Now, I think a good obit gives you a sense of time and place and maybe connects you to the past. And Thelma Hogan at Tucker was the hostess at Matthew's restaurant there. And this was the lead on her obit. Now, I'll tell you about the picture I got to go with it afterwards. At Matthew's cafeteria, a smiling Thelma Hogan called you by your first name, asked after your mama, made sure your cornbread was cooked just like you'd like it, and hugged your child in her lap while she rang up your lunch on the cash register. She did that about 800 times a day for 43 years. I had written this story. It had moved to the line editor, was out of my hands. When I got the photo from the restaurant to run with the obit, and it was a marvelous color photo of Thelma Hogan sitting at the cash register with somebody's baby in her hands, in her arms. And I said, that obit's goddess has helped us again. Another favorite I had was, I have to be honest with you, this obit almost wrote itself because this man's daughter-in-law was so wonderful to talk to. It was just me taking notes down and quotes down as fast as I could. And it's for Claude Miller, who was 104 when he died. He lived in Acworth. Claude Miller started his day with some fried streakaline or fatback and a homemade buttered biscuit with brown sugar on it. Then he set out for a day working at a sawmill, making moonshine and bootlegging on the side. Mr. Miller's schoolhouse was a sawmill. His education was how to take a one-hand bucksaw, fell a tree, and cut off every single limb till it was smooth as butter.
That's pretty
He made apple brandy that I wish the family had a little stash of. But she said even not long before he died, he still wanted to go up to the manse and get some apples and make him some brandy.
You wrote an obituary of your own mom, and it too has some lines in it that have been held up by a lot of people who write obituaries as examples of what you did over the years so well, which was to find little details that told the story.
I don't like writing obits about people I know and family members, but I am called upon to do it, so I do. I think I'm too close to them. I think I'll never be able to do them justice. There's always something that has to be. But anyway, my sisters insisted, and I don't know exactly how it goes, but it was something like there were 13 toothbrushes in her bathroom, all kept there by people who visited her regularly.
Yeah, I will. In fact, I pulled it. The line says, in fact, after she was widowed, there were 13 toothbrushes in her bathroom, all kept there by people who regularly enjoyed her company.
And that's true. That's true. I couldn't believe it. I took a look one day and I counted them and I said, Mama. And that just kind of stuck with me when it came time to write the obit. And you're right. It amazes me the people that home in on that.
You also said, though a frugal woman, Mrs. Powell was generous with her hospitality and private acts of charity, compassion, and friendship. She held to traditional values, but was progressive socially and politically. She accepted with grace whatever circumstances befell her and adapted to life changes. That's a very eloquent tribute to your mother.
Thank you. I consider the family written obit an American folk art. In my obits as a journalist, I tell you somebody died. Families have free rein to discuss death any way they want to. My particular favorite comes from an obit in 1996, family written obit in the Valdosta Daily Times, and this is it. It's my all-time favorite. On Wednesday, November 13th, 1996, God saw fit for Brother Morris Sloan Sr. to tell him all about it.
Is there anything unnerving, unsettling, at times depressing about making an occupation out of writing every day or editing every day stories about people who have just died?
No. In fact, it amazed a lot of people, especially newcomers to the newsroom, how much laughter came from the obit section. It was our job.
Did it make you more aware of the fragility of life, do you think?
I've never been kind of a fatalist, but it did make me think, you're going to die when you're going to die. Perfectly healthy people would come in from jogging and drop dead, or drop dead on the tennis court, or a young married man on his honeymoon would find a little spot and it'd turn into melanoma, and he was a weightlifter and a bodybuilder and healthy. And then I interviewed about people who lived to 114 or 104, and they had good lives up till almost the end when they just kind of hit a wall. And you're just going to die when you're going to die.
Do you think about your obituary?
I don't think about my obituary as much as I think about dying. I read a piece the other day that shows that people who think about dying and death, or go to funeral homes or cemeteries or whatever, actually are happier people. And I have reached the point, since I am older than you, I've got my will done. I've got my list of things that are to be given to people that aren't necessarily covered by the will. And so I've had a happy life. I've had a good life. I'm not ready to go, but if I do, that's all right. There's another adventure ahead of me.
You look wonderful. You clearly are energetic and still thinking. You're smart. So you probably have a long way to go. But do you give no thought to what is that obituary going to be? Who's going to write it? Are they going to be able to capture me accurately and honestly, and also maybe pick out things that will help people understand me as an individual?
First of all, I told the writer, Candace Dyer, she's in charge of writing my obit.
Why Candace Dyer?
I think she's a great writer, and she looks kind of sideways and underneath at people and finds things that aren't. She is a writer. A lot of her work shows up in Atlanta Magazine. She lives up in the mountains. She's been around for a long time. She's a very good writer. She does a lot of writing about musicians and the music scene. So I told Candace, you're in charge of writing my obit. That being said, I have two sisters that probably will go with a dot, 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 dot resume obit for me. I have no idea.
Kay Powell is the former obituaries editor for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In that position, she became well known for her ability to write exceptional stories about the lives of even the most ordinary Georgians. Obituaries remembering the lives of the common woman and man became popular in American newspapers late in the 20th century. But it was in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks that this form was taken to monumental new heights by the New York Times. Beginning on September 14th, just days after the attacks, Times reporters were assigned to write profiles of those who'd perished on September 11th. They began with nothing more than a stack of some 100 missing persons flyers posted at impromptu boards set up around the World Trade Center site. The project grew, and eventually more than 2,500 thumbnail sketches of the victims appeared in the pages of the Times. Today, the Times continues to publish on occasion new profiles on their website. The profiles of grief typically run no more than several hundred words, but each one captures some precious detail of the life of a 9/11 victim.
Gary J. Frank. Though Gary J. Frank programmed computers for a living, he was not the nerdy type. He had a dolphin and a starfish tattooed on his left shoulder because he loved to hang out at the Jersey Shore. And he knew his way around smoke-filled pool halls, taking down more than a few seasoned sharks over the past decade.
Lucille Francis. As a seasoned housekeeper, Lucille Francis took immense pride in polishing the brass and vacuuming the much-trod carpets of Windows of the World on the 107th floor of One World Trade Center.
Leon Smith Jr. Leon Smith Jr.'s boots just might be impossible to feel. He wore the only size 15s in the fire department, said his mother Irene, and he had to have them specially made once he had attained his dream of joining the department.
Nicola Thrapea. She listened to music. She loved Michael Jackson. Before she passed, she had ordered the Michael Jackson album because she loved Michael Jackson. She didn't even get to listen to it.
Muhammad Salman Hamdani. More than anything else, Muhammad Salman Hamdani wanted people to see him for who he truly was, not for who he seemed to be. He was an American citizen, and yet some people continued to see him as something he was not. After Mr. Hamdani, 23, disappeared on September 11th, ugly rumors circulated. He was a Muslim and worked in a lab. He might have been connected to a terrorist group. Months later, the truth came out. Mr. Hamdani's remains had been found near the North Tower, and he had gone there to help everyone he did not know. And then, at last, everyone could see Mr. Hamdani for who he truly was.
Those excerpts from the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning series Portraits of Grief share something important in common with the work of Kay Powell. They both tell us that the lives of each one of us, regardless of wealth, social position, color, or religion, deserve to be celebrated equally at the time of our death. In death, we are all the common man or woman. More recently, the New York Times broke even newer ground in remembering the deceased. The newspaper launched a video project called The Last Word. Individuals are invited to sit down with a New York Times staff member and reflect on his or her life and talk about their views on dying. The videos remain confidential until the subject dies and then are posted online. The most famous of these was the opening line of the video made by Washington humorist Art Buchwald. Listen to what he said.
Hi. I'm Art Buchwald and I just died.
We give Mr. Buchwald the well-deserved last laugh. You're listening to Two Way Street. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. To Americans over the age of about 50, the Cuban Missile Crisis remains in memory as one of the most harrowing experiences of their lives.
President Kennedy will address the nation tonight on radio and television on a subject of the highest national urgency.
On October 22, 1962, President John F. Kennedy broadcast a special message to the nation from his office in the White House.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
For 5 days in October of 1962, the world seemed poised on the brink of nuclear extinction until the crisis broke.
I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved.
The curtain goes up at the United Nations on what the world hopes is the final act in the drama that was the Cuban crisis.
Now, best-selling author Stephen Carter has written a historical novel based on the U.S. intelligence community's desperate efforts to determine whether the Soviets were in fact sending nuclear missiles to Cuba. Carter is a professor of law at Yale University and a highly respected commentator on ethics and religion, the black experience in America, and much more. And so when I sat down to talk with him, we discussed his new novel Back Channel, but also touched on other important themes in his work.
Why did you decide to write about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
It's funny. Very often I tell interviewers that when I write novels, and I've written a lot of them now, I start with a character and then come up with a story. This is the first time I've done it the other way around. This novel had its genesis in two historical facts. One of the historical facts is that when the Cuban Missile Crisis arose, President Kennedy kept a very small group of advisors in the White House and ran these secret negotiations to try to resolve it. But in addition, behind the secret negotiations was even more secret negotiation called the back channel through which the crisis was actually resolved that only three or four people in the White House knew about. That's one of the facts. The other fact, which was revealed in Robert Dallek's excellent biography of Kennedy that came out about 8 years ago, is that while Kennedy was in the White House, he had an affair with a 19-year-old college student. So my thought from those two facts, I couldn't get this out of my head, was what if he didn't have an affair with a 19-year-old college student? What if the affair with a college student was the cover for the back channel negotiations? It's how he managed, you might say, to sneak out of the White House and do various other things so that if anyone discovered the president was involved in something clandestine, they would think it was the affair rather than the negotiations. So I got that idea. I added some background for the woman. I changed her facts from real life. And also add to that some thrills and some threats to her life, and you've got a novel.
She is Margot Jensen in your novel, 19-year-old African-American student who is dragged in to the essentially the spying operation in which the United States is trying to find out what the Russians are shipping to Cuba. Correct.
When we first meet Margot, she's a sophomore at Cornell, majoring in political science with no bigger dream than going to law school. She certainly has no interest in, as you say, being dragged into the middle of what's going on in Cuba. She doesn't even know anything is going on in Cuba. One of the striking things about the Cuban Missile Crisis in real life is how long it took the U.S. government to decide that there were missiles being moved into Cuba. The operation went on for months before the Central Intelligence Agency was able to figure out there were actually missiles being moved into Cuba. As late as about a month before the missiles were discovered, the official national intelligence estimate informed the White House that there was very little chance that Khrushchev would ever try to put nuclear missiles in Cuba. And that national intelligence estimate was issued while he was trying to do that. So the image I try to present in my book is of a national security establishment frantically trying to find out what happened in Cuba. They get a cryptic message relayed by a chess player, Bobby Fischer, who I always wanted to put in a novel. And somehow, through a variety of circumstances, that cryptic message being relayed to Bobby Fischer leads them to drag Margot, who for a variety of reasons is the only person who can do it, into a trip to Bulgaria, where she's supposed to find out what's actually going on.
There's a world chess tournament taking place in Bulgaria. Bobby Fischer is playing in the tournament, and Margot is sent to essentially accompany him, and allegedly because he is going to have a contact that will help clarify what the Russians are sending. We don't want to give away too much.
Don't want to give away too much, but that's in the first part of the book, and that's okay. And Bobby Fischer is a fascinating character. Here we have the greatest chess player this country has ever produced, one of the greatest the world has ever produced. First became world champion in his late 20s, and then late in his life went off the deep end, became anti-Semitic very powerfully, virulently anti-Semitic, became homophobic very virulently, became anti-American. There was just there was something horrible going on in his head. The seeds for that probably arose pretty early. And exaggerating slightly some of the stories about him, I try to illustrate both sides of his personality. But his main role in the book is to get Margot to Bulgaria, which is where the fun begins.
Yeah. If I do the math correctly, I think you may have been around 9 or 10 when the Cuban Missile Crisis actually took place.
Now, give me, don't add too many years to my, to me. I was 8. I turned 8 in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
What do you remember about those days?
My memory is a little confused because sometimes I don't know how much of it I'm remembering and how much of it I learned later. The thing I do remember is people packing their cars. We had a little house in Southwest, and I remember people packing their cars. It was middle of the school year, as they're going on vacation. Some people just left town. I have a very clear memory of that, and that's in the book. I don't remember my parents ever sitting us down and telling us what happened. I do remember, however, a conversation I had with a classmate. I was in third grade. By the lockers in my elementary school, in which we were talking about what would happen if a bomb hit Washington. I remember that. I don't think we had any sense of what it meant to have a nuclear explosion, but we had this just a kind of casual conversation, because remember, those were the days we used to have air raid drills, especially in Washington. The first Wednesday of every month, I think it was the first Wednesday at noon, the air raid siren would go off, and all the school kids would, I think at my elementary school, we went into the halls. We didn't have a basement, into the halls, and turned our backs to the window, as that's going to protect us somehow in case something happened. I find that when I talk to younger people today about the Cuban Missile Crisis, it's hard to get them to understand why it was such a crisis, why people were so scared, that this is a moment that is as close to annihilation as the world has ever come in its history. And had a few decisions been made in slightly different directions, we would have had a war in which at least, at minimum, hundreds of millions of people would have been killed probably in a few days.
Were you old enough at 8 years old to really be terrified the way so many Americans were?
I was not old enough to be terrified because I really didn't understand what was going on. But it's very easy reading the historical accounts to see how much panic there was. A lot of people left the cities. Since the 50s, people have been digging fallout shelters anyway, but some people started digging more fallout shelters in their backyards, especially out in rural areas and so on. It was really quite a remarkable time in our history. And one of the things I try to do in the book, in addition to writing what I hope is a thriller, is to bring that alive.
Do you think that the fact that, as you said, it's the closest we came to annihilation had an influence on why you decided to write about this? And whether it did or not, why a novel when you certainly could have written a nonfiction book about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I teach at Yale a course on the ethics of war, and I do a lot of writing about the subject. And when I teach the ethics of war, we spend a week on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Part of it is trying to get the students to understand why it was a crisis. And the other thing we talk about is what decisions Kennedy could have made differently. And one of the things that I always try to get across to students, and I thought I would try to get across in a novel, is there's an interesting question about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Why did Khrushchev blink and Kennedy didn't blink? Why did the U.S. prevail without a war? And you'll find a lot of people on the left today who will say, well, it's because we negotiated hard. You find a lot of people on the right who will say, it's because we had our planes in the air and we showed them we were going to attack. But I think the real answer is somewhere in the middle, that what Kennedy did extraordinarily well, and in fact an important lesson I think for negotiators and policymakers today, is to keep Khrushchev guessing. To this day, historians do not know with any certainty whether Kennedy was willing to go to war or not. He kept that card so close to his vest. The reason that Khrushchev blinked, I think, was because in the end, he found the president of the United States too unpredictable. He tried to put the missiles in because he thought he knew how Kennedy would respond. He realized he was wrong, not in the sense that, oh, he will definitely go to war, but in the sense of, I have no idea what he'll do. And that act of keeping off balance is something that is important to convey, I think, about the crisis. And I think that a novel in which Kennedy is a character is a good way to convey it, because one of the things I try to show is the advisors around him thinking he's being indecisive when what he's really doing is trying to hold the reins of this thing, when he's got half his advisors telling him you've got to live with the missiles and the other half saying you've got to bomb them today, and he's trying to hold on to that middle ground tenaciously. We see a lot of that through Margot's eyes, because although she's only 19, she's in a sense the only person he can talk to who doesn't have a position on the thing. He's not trying to push him one way or the other, and so ends up talking to her a lot about his thinking.
At one point, fairly early in the book, Margot Jensen is in a position where she has to think about something that someone has just said to her. And here's what she reflects upon. She thought of the old Negro families she knew, some of them with millions in the bank, few Americans, black or white, were aware of their existence.
Well, we live in a time today when people are accustomed to black professionals, black lawyers, black doctors, black president of the United States, and so on. It's not thought to be unusual, but I would say that most Americans, black and white, think of that as a fairly recent phenomenon, a phenomenon of the last generation or two. In several, not all, but in several of my novels, I've tried to highlight the existence of families that have been professionally successful for many, many generations. There's a family in Massachusetts that built ships for the British in the 18th century, a black family that started as a shipbuilding family. There were black families who fought on the Confederate side in the Civil War because they didn't want to lose their slaves. So it doesn't compute for a lot of people. They can't make any sense of the argument. There are black families that have been professionally successful for a long time in a country that for most of its history has been severely oppressive on the basis of race. And so that the ability of those families to carve out that niche and to succeed against those odds, I think is something to be celebrated. And it's sad that people don't know that history. Again, that history of a handful of families doesn't excuse our larger obligation, given where we are, but it's still an important history to be aware of, that in the face of segregation, in the face of Jim Crow, in the face of racism generally, there are families that have been succeeding for a very, very long time.
You're right. It's contrary to everything we would think about the history of the people in this state.
No, it's true. Georgia actually was an interesting state during the slaveholding era. There are some states, Georgia was one of them, where slaveholding was heavily concentrated in the upper classes. There were other states, Kentucky, for example, where a lot of people of moderate means owned slaves. But Georgia was big plantations, rich people owning slaves. Most of the working class people didn't own slaves. Georgia and North Carolina both had that in common. There were a lot of working class black families in Georgia at the time of the Civil War. There might have been one or two families that were wealthy enough to own slaves in Georgia, not many. Most of those were in other parts of the South. But it is the case that Georgia in particular, in and around Atlanta, by the late 19th century, in and around Atlanta, you had a number of black professional families growing up and a number of big black businesses founded as well. And that was really quite important because in the days of segregation, of course, a lot of white business people wouldn't do business with black people. And so people look around, they say, well, look, in the black community, you always see these black undertakers, these black doctors and so on. That's because these are services people need. And if the market won't provide them because of prejudice, someone else will provide them. So you had this enormous growth of the black professional class beginning in areas, and insurance was another one, where a lot of white businesses simply wouldn't do business with black people. And Atlanta was one of the big early centers of that. And you had well-to-do black families in Atlanta more than 100 years ago.
There are great twists and turns in this book.
I hope so.
It is very suspenseful. And so if it's okay with you, I'd like to leave back channel, but I'd like to talk a little more about you and your career. You had an opportunity to clerk for two men who were, before they became judges, giants in the civil rights movement. Both of them were deeply involved as attorneys in Brown versus Board of Education. Spotswood Robinson, District Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and then Associate Justice Thurgood Marshall of the U.S. Supreme Court. What did you learn from those two men?
Judge Robinson and Justice Marshall are two of my heroes, and certainly you're right to raise the point because they were two of my mentors, and I did learn a lot from them, and the lessons I learned from them are different with the two men. Justice Marshall, of course, was chief counsel of the NAACP and then the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and he had been involved in lots of cases, and indeed as part of the point of what I learned from him, this was a man who had litigated cases all over the United States, in the South certainly, but also in the Midwest, and we forget in the Northeast as well, often at great risk to his own life. And one of the things I learned from those that was really quite astonishing, with all the history behind him, with all the things that had been done to him, with all the threats to him and the people he'd known in his life, I never heard him say a bad word, really, about anyone, that he would talk about some of the famous segregationists of the age, of the 40s and 50s, and he used to say, I didn't care what speeches he gave or what he had to say to get elected. I cared, could you do business with him? If you sat down with him in a back room and made a deal, was his word good? That was all that mattered to me. And he would talk a lot about deals that were made in back rooms with people whose political views he and you and I would abhor, But you sat down and met with them anyway because that's what you did in those days. And one of the things that's so appalling about politics today on both sides of the aisle is that it seems personal for these people. If I disagree with you, we can't have a meeting. I'd rather go on a talk show and blast you, but I certainly can't sit down and have a chat. And Justice Marshall, I got to know him even better toward the end of his life because I was also the interviewer for his oral history, which we were working on actually when he died. We had spent the previous year, we didn't finish, but spent the previous year working on his oral history. And that was one of the things that became clear is that he had a certain amount of disillusionment. And this is years ago. This is 1991, 92, when we were doing this. But already by then, he was quite disillusioned about American politics and had a sense that people just didn't feel they could sit down with each other and talk anymore and try to reach a deal, and that people didn't keep their word anymore, which appalled him perhaps most of all.
Where are we headed as we lock into our ideologies, refuse to engage with people who disagree with us?
For me, it depends which day you ask me. So I have days when I'm very pessimistic. I have days when I look at the way that people, they tune in the network that agrees with them, they look at the websites that agree with them, they read the newspaper that agrees with them, and so they live in a world of agreement, and that's on the left and the right alike. So I have days when I look at that and I worry. And when people tell me, oh, our politics have always been nasty, that's true. The difference is when our politics were nasty, say, in the 1820s, people did politics maybe 10 days a year, not 365 days a year, and that's a huge difference. On the other hand, with all the problems that we face a lot of problems. We face problems in the economy. We face problems abroad. We face problems of the real challenge of poverty. I still believe that there is an American idea around which people can rally and be optimistic. And part of the American idea is equality. That's not all of it. Part of it is freedom. Part of it is generosity of spirit. And I think it's possible to return to that spirit of generosity in ways that will help us once more take our place as we should, an example of how democracy ought to be run.
Stephen Carter is a professor of law at Yale University. His latest novel, Backchannel, tells the story of the spying and intrigue surrounding the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's all for this week. I hope you'll join me again next Saturday at 4 for another edition of Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Have a great week.